You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 243, ETS Interviews Part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland. He's the scholar, Dr. Micah Heiser. Hey, Mike, another day.
Yeah, it's been busy, kind of hectic.
It has. It's always fun to try to find a setup, where to set up to record these. And we've added video this year, so yeah. Hopefully that turns out well. But, you know, we've commandeered several chairs at a table. Mike and I stole a table from a ballroom. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah,
but,
well, you know, we file that under. It's easier to get forgiveness than permission. So that's just kind of how we roll.
Absolutely. Well, who we got for this episode?
Well, this episode we have David Capes, who is an expert in New Testament and Second Temple Judaism. David is, you know, was sort of an early member of what the academic community would sort of call early High Christology or early Jewish binitarian Christology. Again, those of you who have read Unseen Realm, of course, know that what all that means is, you know, the idea of Jesus as God that has a history that is deeply rooted textually and historically. And so David was part of that. I mean, way back in the 90s, he's still part of that. He has a new book out that's really aimed at the non-specialist. So I thought when I saw that, you know, this is going to be an ideal person to have an interview with. And then along with David, we have Gary Brashears. Gary is going to be familiar to the audience. He was on the promotional video for Unseen Realm. He's been a friend for a long time. He's connected to the Bible Project. He's really sort of helped me make some connections in the wider evangelical world. Gary's a systematic theologian up in the Pacific Northwest, in the region where I'm at now. But he and I have a fairly long history, so I thought it would be fun to have him on the podcast and talk about what he actually does. And then after him, we have Mark Futato. Again, his name will be familiar to some who have taken a Memra course in Hebrew. We use his grammar. But Mark is going to spend some time with us and talk about Hebrew, no surprise there, and some things he's been working on. And I should tell the audience that, you know, Mark has been a really, you know, I think enthusiastic adopter, you know, a fan of the book Unseen Realm. So unlike Gary that I had this history with, you know, Mark comes along and really, again, has appreciated the work. But we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what he does again. That's the whole purpose of what we're doing here. Hi, everybody. We're back at the annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society here in Denver. And with us now is Dr. David Capes. And if you are a close reader of Unseen Realm, that name will be familiar because he's in the footnotes to the book. David is one of the leading scholars in early High Christology. And I'm going to ask him to introduce himself, basically where he teaches, what he teaches, you know, degrees, whatnot, however you want to introduce yourself.
Okay.
And then for the sake of the audience who might not be as up to speed, tell us what early High Christology is.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks so much. Yep. David Capes, my name. I teach at Wheaton College. I'm the dean of the Biblical Theological Studies program at mm-hmm. Wheaton College, which includes undergraduate and graduate studies. The book that we're talking about is called The Divine Christ, Paul, the Lord Jesus, and the Scriptures
of
Israel.
Hold it up.
Yeah, I've been at Wheaton College only a couple of years. Before that, 25 years teaching at Houston Baptist University. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of the early people, or one of the people involved in the Early High Christology Club. There's actually a group of us who are scholars that have mm-hmm. written books or articles arguing that from the very earliest moment in history that we have, which is the writings of the Apostle Paul, that there are expressions of a high Christology or a divine Christology in those texts. Mm-hmm. The worship of Jesus is described. There are particular titles associated with Jesus, particular actions associated with Jesus that could only really be understood as if early Christians like Paul mm-hmm. and who are Jews understood Jesus to be divine, one
right.
with God.
Right. Would I imagine there's some diversity within the club, but they would understand Paul as expressing the idea that Jesus was Yahweh incarnate, somehow attaching him to Yahweh.
Jesus is the embodiment of God. Yeah, one of the things I do in this particular book is take a look at those 14 or 15 places in Paul where he's quoting or alluding to an Old Testament text that is associated with the divine name. Now, you've got to know that the divine name is understood to have unbelievable reverence at this particular time. It wasn't to be spoken. Right. It wasn't to be written lightly. When you, even when you were reading scripture in the synagogue, when you came to the four letters, the Yod, the Hey, the Vav, the Hey of the divine name, you were to substitute a word. In the provinces where Greek was spoken, they would substitute the word Kurios, and that becomes the word associated particularly with Jesus. Over 200 times in the New Testament, Paul refers to Jesus as the Kurios.
Yeah, and Kurios means Lord.
Right.
Again, so when you read Lord in your English Bible, you know, in these quotations, this is what's happening.
Yeah, in the Old Testament, a lot of times when you look through and you see the word Lord, it's spelled the same way, L-O-R-D, but you might have uppercase letters or lowercase. That's to signal to the reader that when it's all uppercase, that we have an expression of the divine name.
Yeah.
And I don't know how early that goes back. Probably the 11th or 12th century, where the word Lord was substituted for the divine name. Now, in the old King James Bible, about six or seven times, they use the word Jehovah. But that's actually sort of a composite word, not really the divine name.
Yeah. So, again, this is important subject matter because, you know, there's this notion, you know, out in the wacky world of the internet, which I affectionately refer to as Middle Earth, that high Christology, the notion of the deity of Christ, you know, Yahweh is incarnate, the Trinitarian stuff that goes with it, that's a contrivance that comes much later than the New Testament period. And so your work and the work of others basically, you know, seriously is a good rebuttal to that kind of thing, that if you're going to go off and call this a contrivance, there are a lot of data here that you're not dealing with.
There's a ton of information. Yeah, I don't know that we've won the day completely. There's still a few scholars out there who say, well, it develops over time. We call that the late, low, and slow club. We're the early high Christology club. Then there's the late, low, and slow club. People like Jimmy Dunn, for example, who make the case in his book that it's probably not until you get to the Gospel of John that you have a full-orbed divine Christology. We think actually the evidence points to the fact that Paul, our earliest theologian, and even the traditions that he cites, the hymn bits that he cites as part of what Musk, Gottfather Earl Ellis called preformed tradition, that it's even present there, which takes us back within maybe a decade or two of the execution of Jesus. So this happens very, very early.
Yeah. Do you connect it at all, either in this book or some other book, with... You know, you have your Memra traditions. You know, that would be another trajectory to follow to sort of make the same point.
Yeah, no, I haven't done that in this particular book. I'm trying to think if I know of anybody
like
who's doing that.
Daniel Boyerin, you know, has done a good bit of recent work, you know, and the two powers, you know, building off what Siegel.
Right.
You know,
Alan Siegel, who was a Jewish New Testament scholar, was a member. Mug-carrying member of our early High Christology Club.
Good for him.
He was there when it was founded. It was actually founded back in Chicago back in 1995 or 6 at the SBL meeting. There's an interesting story about that, but that would probably take us longer.
Is there a unique contribution in this book compared to some other things? You know, feel free to mention your other books.
Yeah.
Is there something unique about this book that – isn't in the other ones, or is this a distillation, or how would you
characterize? Yeah, this is actually, I did a book a number of years ago published in the Wundt series, Wissenschaftliche Untersuchungen zum Neuen Testament.
Yep.
And Martin Hingel was the one who helped to get that published. And essentially, it was called Old Testament Yahweh Text in Paul's Christology.
Yep.
That was sort of more of an academic version of this. But since then, what I've done is actually engaged other scholars who've written on the topic and tried to bring the book up to date. But I have looked at these expressions of what I call Yahweh Text, where the divine name is now translated or rendered as Kurios and now applied to Jesus. Now, it's not every time. There are a number of times that it's referred to God the Father, demonstrating that it's not just something that Paul does.
Right. But the fact that he would do it to both.
The fact that he does it in both places.
Yeah.
is to both figures becomes very significant for me. So make that argument there. Also take up some things that Chris Tilling has written about in his book, Paul's Divine Christology, where I think he makes a wonderful case that that in a sense, the language that is associated with the relationship of Yahweh to Israel is now sort of taken over by Paul to say this is the right way to speak about the relation between Jesus, the Lord Jesus, and his church, his people. So interesting relational.
That's an interesting for lack of a better term, a roundabout way, again, to make the same point.
Yeah, I think a number of us are making the same point. Larry Hurtado is a good friend of mine, teaches University of Edinburgh, and he's made the case that from very early on, we see Jesus being, in a sense, an object of worship among early Christians, and he calls it Christ devotion. That's his term. And he's written about that in the book, Lord Jesus Christ, among other places, that when you look at the behavior, the disposition, it wasn't just what people believed. It's about religion. It was about what people did and how did they refer. How were their bodies and how was their disposition toward Jesus? Yeah. And it really can only be one described as one of worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Larry and I mean, I don't spend a whole lot of time with Larry, but Larry's one of the few scholars who's actually read my dissertation.
All right.
And he actually told me he read it twice. We have one sort of disagreement. I think that the binitarian structure is actually evident in the Old Testament as well. And that
this morning.
It's a precursor, it's a category precursor, to help kind of parse what comes later. And it becomes... The people who are writing in the Second Temple period are noticing certain trajectories, I believe, from the Old Testament. Mm. I'm a Semitics guy, and so to cut to the chase, and what Larry and I have talked about a few times is in Canaanite religion, you had a divine council that was headed by two separate deities, El and Baal. Mm. And to me, it's significant that not only does Yahweh get El language attributed to him and Baal language attributed to him, sort of fusing those two into the one, God of Israel.
Right.
But a second figure also gets Baal language, and Baal is the number two guy in the Canaanite pantheon.
Now, is it Margaret Barker's argument as well?
Barker, I would disagree with Barker because I think I don't want to say Barker is more of a polytheist, but she sees some of the same things, but she sort of works a different evolutionary arc that still includes an evolution from polytheism to monotheism. I don't believe in that trajectory. I think it's inherently incoherent at points. And I don't want to digress too far, but you have the binitarian or the two deity structure from Canaan, I think gets mimicked and altered in Israelite religion, where you have a transcendent Yahweh, an invisible Yahweh, and then a physicalized Yahweh or an anthropomorphized Yahweh, applying, essentially filling both slots.
Ezekiel 1, seeing the Kavod Yahweh.
Daniel 7, Daniel 7. Big thing that was important to Siegel, the Son of Man passage, in his book, The Two Powers, it drew so much attention.
Right.
And Siegel in his book says that he thought that the whole Two Powers thing came from divine warrior stuff in the Old Testament Israelite religion. He's correct in that, but it's actually a bigger picture than that. So, as part of my dissertation drew me into your work and, works by Hurtado and other people, because I see this sort of as a repurposing or repackaging or whatever term we're going to use,
right?
That they're building off a category that they're familiar with. And then in between the Testament, you have all the speculation. Well, who's the second power? Mm-hmm. Who's the divine man? From Ezekiel 1 and Daniel 7, and it's either a deified human or a special angel or something like that.
Yeah,
but you have the category is the important thing.
That's it. Okay.
And then that gets built on. So yeah. I'm a Semitics guy, but I read a lot of Second Temple stuff. And New Testament as it relates, to this kind of material.
To this question.
Yeah, it's really valuable. And our audience, since our podcast, we get into a lot of these subjects. We're very content oriented. And people are starving for content. They really are.
I think that's true.
And they've picked up on a lot of these things and found it really interesting. So when I saw your new book, come out, I thought, this is a good time to talk to you.
Good time to talk about this. Yeah. Glad we're together.
Yeah. For our audience, you need to get the divine Christ, and I'm glad you characterize it the way you did, sort of a readable, not less scholarly, but, you know, written for someone who isn't a specialist.
Written for a broader audience. Yeah. We tried to put it on a shelf that people could reach, basically.
Yeah, this is, and it's going to be more affordable, trust me.
Yeah.
You know, than the academic literature. Yeah. So
Vundt volume's about $70. This is about $20, $25.
Oh, I know. It's like just, that. You know, you go to the Brill Table or Morris Seebeck and take out a loan. You know?
Yeah.
The Divine Christ, again, highly recommended that if you're interested in high Christology and some of the things we've been talking about, please get the book. You'll find it very interesting and rewarding. So
yeah.
Thanks for spending some time with us.
Glad to do it. Yeah. Enjoyed the time.
Thank you. Well, we're back at ETS annual meeting in Denver, and we have with us Gary Brashears. Now, his face will be familiar to a number of you who remember several years ago now the video promoting Unseen Realm. He was an early supporter, was in that video, and so we're thrilled to welcome him. But for those of you who didn't see that, and to whom he would be new, I'm going to ask him to introduce himself.
Okay. Well, I'm a friend of Mike Heiser's from way back when, and that makes me absolutely infamous and notorious and hated by the whole world.
Enemy of the Academy.
Totally. No, it's a... I'm a Western seminary. My home base is in Portland, but I teach in San Jose and Sacramento and Seattle, and we have gatherings that happen in Anchorage, Alaska. And I've not been to a gathering in Honolulu yet, but perhaps it will happen. So I teach, my primary is theology, mm-hmm. but I teach the whole Bible as well. And then topics like spiritual warfare and such. And so I got interested in the Dan Brown stuff when Da Vinci Code came out because of the nonsense that was done there, particularly the worldview behind it. And that's when I'm like, Mike, because he was doing a podcast or an ETS paper on the worldview behind that.
Yep,
and I went to it. That. I never heard of Mike Heiser, but the topic was interesting. And I heard this. I said, man, this guy gets it. So we had a long, intense conversation, and it's history from there. But I've been at Western almost 40 years and had all kinds of students and been promoting what is now Unseen Realm since before Unseen Realm existed.
Yep.
And I've learned a lot from Mike, and I don't think I've taught you anything.
I read years ago, you did an article in Jets on the covenants.
Yeah.
You know, back when the whole dispensational covenant theology, progressive dispensational thing was going on. So, yeah, you have taught me something. That was a good article. Very helpful.
I did that thing on progressive dispensationalism as a plenary. Would have been like 1992. And it was at that point, it was brand new. Mm-hmm. And I was the one that really introduced progressive dispensationalism to the world through that plenary paper. It was a study group we had here at ETS. And, you know, I've always been causing trouble for people. And that's why you and I like each other so much, I think.
It must be. And by the way, progressive there is a good term.
Yes.
It's not like a liberalizing of anything, but progressive dispensational is sort of a mediating position between your covenantal and your sort of Ryrie.
Well, I'd like to say it's a more biblical presentation of dispensationalism than classic stuff. We do continuity between Israel and church as well as discontinuity, where classic dispensationalism, the two are never connected.
Right, right.
And in covenantalism, there's really not much difference between them. And that's been developed a lot since.
Yeah, either of the old systems or the other systems, I should say, it's an either or, but with progressive, it's a both and.
Yeah, the sense that church never fulfills any of Israel's prophecy, classic, or the supersessionism, as it's called, mm-hmm. the replacement theology, where the church replaces Israel, and there's no future for God's. Is a Jewish people.
It's just an overstatement.
Yeah. So progressive dispensation, the way I would say it, is that there's a national future for Israel as a double blessed firstborn nation among the nations. But instead of separating the two completely the way classic does, or just putting them all together mm-hmm. as covenantalism, I think there will be nations, tribes in the millennium, and the Jewish will be a double blessed firstborn type nation. So there's a lot of fun behind that.
Yeah. Now, you have a very close relationship to the Bible Project.
I do.
So why don't you tell us about that?
The Bible Project, my connection began with Tim Mackey.
Yeah.
When he was a Multnomah student. I got introduced to him through Ray Lubeck, and we connected, and he came to Western and did an MA with us. I drug him off to Odessa, Ukraine, along with Jessica, to teach Ukrainian pastors along with me. Mm-hmm. So he's up in front of these pastors drawing little mountains on the whiteboard, and you see where the drawings have come from there. I mean, they were just entranced by what he was teaching. And then he went to Madison to do his PhD, and we maintained a very close friendship. And then he was at Black Hawk Church there as teaching pastor. Mm-hmm. And I was having him come back and do some adjunct teaching for me. And I helped negotiate getting back to Portland. And then he and John Collins connected. They'd been classmates at Multnomah. Yeah. And so they needed somebody that somebody'd heard of. So they asked me to be on the board. Yeah. And I'm keenly interested in what they're doing. So I got into the ground floor, and I've been on the board, still am on the board, and be a theological biblical advisor. So I review scripts and those kind of things. And it helps them from terrible mistakes, not all of them. Mm-hmm. But they had a picture of Jesus, and they had him sawing something with a saw. And I said, wait a minute, that's not what they do. They're like craftsmen. They do stone, not wood. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I changed the video to him chiseling on something. Yeah, and so I saved him for a terrible mistake.
Well, I'm sure they were appreciative of that.
It's a lot of fun. And just seeing how Bible Project has become one of the key teaching things for Scripture in the whole world. We're working on the translations now. We're headed out toward 50 translations.
Wow.
So a friend of mine is in Mongolia, Jen and Corey Ellison. And Corey sent me an email and said, hey, we've got some people who do Mongolian. Is the Bible Project ever coming into Mongolian? And I thought, Mongolian?
Yeah.
I don't know. I got him in touch with Ken Weigel. Sure enough, Mongolian's on our list, and it will now go up about 10 languages because of the connection through Corey.
There's a connection there,
So if you want to read the Bible in Mongolian, there'll be a Bible Project for you in about 3 years.
Is that adding subtitles or what is involved in
that? No. What we do is we translate the script using carefully selected and trained translators.
Right. Good idea. Yeah.
And then the sketchbook videos, put it in Mongolian.
Wow.
I've seen the Arabic stuff. And so it's looking at the creation video, for example, and it's in Arabic. And when it writes it, instead of writing left to right with English letters, it's writing from right to left in Arabic letters. It's entire change on that. So it's a high-level translation team that views professional video
people. Yeah, that's a lot of work.
As well as, it's about, it runs $50,000, $70,000 a translation. And so we're having people fund it. There are people who really want the Bible Project in the major languages. So it's very fun to see this happen. Wow. So it'll go out in 50 languages. We're almost done with Cantonese, nearly done with Spanish, well underway in French, German, Indonesian, Arabic, and it's going hard at it because we really want to bring this basic teaching to the whole world, not just the English-speaking world.
Now, you last thing we should hit on, you do a lot of travel.
I do.
You mentioned, you're teaching internationally, so... Is that something you do because you're invited personally, or do you do it on behalf of the seminary, or a little bit of both?
All I do is in personal invitations through friends in various places. So I teach all the way from untrained pastors in the Philippines on how to go from text to sermon to do expositional teaching. And these are guys, one of the past guys I did here 2 years ago when I was in the Philippines. If you know Manila, you know the Quiapo slum, which is one of the worst slums in the world. That's where he grew up. Mm. He was born in the slum. At 5 years old, he hated his dad so bad that he said, I'm going to survive and kill that man at 5 years old. I mean, his life was that hard. At 13, he was desperate for food, went into church because they would give him food, joined the youth group, was doing a drama where they were competing among churches, and the church that won this drama competition would get a cash prize, and the guys told him, we'll give this to you if we win. Well, they're doing the Good Samaritan video. Mm-hmm. So if you got a really tough slum kid, what role would you give him in a... Right. He's the robber, of course, who beats up on the Jewish guy. Well, he got a little carried away with it and hauled a switchblade and went after him, was going to kill him. Well, that didn't go over real well. Right. He ended up in jail on assault charges, got saved in jail. Mm-hmm. I mean, genuinely saved. And the chaplain said, you need to go back and forgive your father. And he said, I'll kill the blankety blank, but I'll never forgive him. Yeah. And the guy just listened to him, showed him scripture, and he went back to his home, found his dad, not stone drunk, but typically drunk. Right. He picked him up off the chair, hugged him, and said, I forgive you, Dad, and felt his dad hug him back. 2 years later, he baptized his father.
Wow.
He was one of my students in the Philippines.
Boy, yeah.
2 weeks later, I was teaching Doctor of Ministry students at International Graduate Student School of Leadership. I get to do everything.
Yeah. If you can handle that, I mean, because I follow you on Twitter, it's like, really? You're where? And now you're I don't know how you handle all this.
Most recently in Beirut, overseas. And I get to do a lot of very cool stuff.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing a few minutes with us. Tell us about yourself and what you do. And I'm sure the audience is going to, now you're going to be on the map now with them.
Oh, yeah. Friend of Mike Heiser, so I'm famous.
Maybe they'll give you more to do. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Welcome back to our interviews at the Evangelical Theological Society meeting in Denver. We have with us now Mark Futato. That name will be familiar to some of you who have done some Hebrew study either through me or somewhere else online, because Mark is the author, the creator of, I think, arguably the best-selling Hebrew, introductory Hebrew grammar. So that would be where some of you may have heard of him. Mark and I go back a long way with Logos, with Mobile Ed. He's a professor who did a Mobile Ed course, actually more than one Mobile Ed course at this point for us. But he was there from the very beginning, so some of you might know him from there. But for those of you who don't, I'm going to ask him to introduce himself briefly. And there are a few things we want to talk about that I think our audience will be interested in. So
thanks, Mike.
Tell them who you are.
My name is Mark Futato, as Mike said. I am currently a professor of Hebrew and Old Testament at RTS Orlando. I've been there for 20 years now. Before that, I taught for 11 years at Westminster in California. And before that, I was a pastor of a local church outside the Washington, D.C. area. Backing up from there, I did my graduate studies at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. And prior to that, I did my seminary studies at Westminster in Philadelphia. And I started all of this as an undergrad at Geneva College, just outside of Pittsburgh.
Wow. So, I mean, you're a Semitist, obviously, Semitic languages, biblical Hebrew, that sort of thing. What do you teach now? Give us an example of what your teaching schedule's like. What do they have you doing?
Well, currently, my over half of my teaching is Hebrew.
Okay.
We have a sequence on the Orlando campus of Hebrew 1, Hebrew 2, that's mainly grammar, and then Hebrew 3, which is exegesis. And until now, I've been teaching two different tracks. One of those tracks has been traditional. I use my beginning biblical Hebrew, 40 chapters. It's all just very traditional, face-to-face classroom Hebrew instruction. The other track that I've been teaching for a good number of years has been innovative. It is only half of the grammar that you would learn in a traditional track. So what do I do with the other half of my time? Mm-hmm. I teach students how to use Logos software as the other part of their Hebrew class. I jokingly tell my students in the electronic track that I'm only going to give them half of the Hebrew to forget over the years. Right. But I do guarantee them that for the rest of their ministry, they're going to be using what they have learned in my coursework. And it is gratifying. Yeah. I get emails from students who have been out of school for 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years. And they say, thanks for what you taught me in that electronic track. I am using my Hebrew and my Logos software in my ministry all the time. Yeah. And that's really the way it should be.
And that, you know, just to be honest about it, that's quite different than someone who only had, you know, a traditional course that had really no kind of tools-based approach at all. Because, I mean, who has, when you go on the ministry, who has 5 or 10 hours a week to keep up with vocabulary and forms?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not realistic.
No. And the other thing about that is it really, it in terms of the outcomes, mm-hmm. it gives you the outcomes that you're looking for. In a typical seminary curriculum, we don't have nearly enough time to get students anywhere near competency in mm-hmm. reading Hebrew.
Right.
But we can really teach them how to use good, sophisticated software. I maintain that for a pastor or a serious student of the Bible, a teacher, they can't really use the best of what is inside Logos if they don't at least know a modicum mm-hmm. of Greek and Hebrew. Mm-hmm. They need to have heard of a PL and a hifil, and yep. they need yep. to know that melech is a noun and it's not an adverb. But with that modicum of Hebrew grammar, they can really, two P's, since I'm Presbyterian, okay. two P's. One of those is precise. Mm-hmm. I give the example that if you're studying Psalm 1 and you see that word blessed, you say, oh, let me find all the examples of that. If you're mm-hmm. limited to English, you find all of the occurrences of B-L-E-S-S-E-D.
Yep.
The problem is there's no precision there because you've got a bunch of Ashrays and you've got a bunch of Baruchs and you don't even know it.
Right. You got different Hebrew lemmas get the same English
translation. I teach students enough Hebrew, and with the ease of use in Logos, I teach them to right-click, and then they can find all of the Hebrew words that are underlying the blessed in Psalm 1.
Yeah.
So, number one, their Bible study is going to be much more precise. But number two, it's also going to be more profound because there are a lot of tools. Let's just say the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without knowing Hebrew, you can use that. But you cannot use it as well and as profoundly if you don't know at least sure. how to sound out and read the Hebrew words.
Yeah.
So that's been my basic philosophy. Now, I just found out that this year is the last year that I'm going to be allowed to teach that.
Oh, wow.
So all of my students are going to have to go through the traditional track. So I'm actually thinking about what to do about that. And you've had some experience with this, mm-hmm. Mike. And mm-hmm. so you and I need to chat more. I'm actually thinking about how to perhaps expand my basichebrew.com website, which mm-hmm. is just the Hebrew lessons and just the Logos lessons,
mm-hmm.
and turn it into a subscription-based Hebrew course, mm-hmm. Hebrew 1 and Hebrew 2, because I really think that it's valuable, not just for people who are studying for professional ministry,
right.
but for anybody in the church who wants a more precise and more profound understanding of the Bible.
No,
so over the year, over the coming year, I'm going to be looking at how to maybe start to teach that on my own. Something like what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. So
now, you had in the few minutes we had before we went live here, you mentioned that there's an MDiv program at RTS that is largely distance.
Yes.
Where I want you to talk a little bit about that, but where does Hebrew fall in that program?
Okay, a couple of things. First, I'll talk about the program as a whole. RTS has always been a league leader in terms of seminary education mm-hmm. and being online.
Right.
I think we were the first to offer a fully online MAR.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been in this game a long time. And under David John, we have some really good leadership. On the Orlando campus, well, let me back up a minute. A couple of years ago, the accrediting agencies finally granted permission to give a fully online MDiv.
Okay.
Since it's a professional degree, they were always of the opinion that there had to be some level of face-to-face education.
Yeah, yeah.
But they've done away with that. Well, our board was appreciative of that, but wasn't willing to go the full way into an online program. But in Orlando, we're experimenting with a distance MDiv or a hybrid MDiv. And what that means is to get your Orlando MDiv, you only need 33 hours of on-campus credit. But and the rest you can do online at whatever campus you can get to. But another dimension of that is we have provided a fair number of those courses in a hybrid format. That means that students will do half of the course online before they ever come to campus.
Mm-hmm.
So these hybrid or distance MDiv students are able to do their MDiv degree without ever uprooting because
yeah.
they can get all of their online credits. All of their Orlando residential credits mm-hmm. by coming in Januaries and summers.
Yeah.
Now, back in the day, a student could come for 1 week. That's one airfare, room and board. But because all of those hours had to be in class, you could only do one class.
Yeah.
Now, with the ability to do half of that work before you even get there, we have students who will do three classes in 1 week. And so that is really efficient with regard to their funds and their time away from family. So the hybrid or distance MDiv, which isn't on all the RTS campuses, it's just RTS Orlando, it's really a great program.
It sounds to me like if you're doing, I mean, if you triple up like that, what is that, three or four times, you can get close to wiping out that residency?
Yeah, you can actually, we have a couple of curricular structures set up.
Okay.
I don't know that anybody's done it, but in theory, there is a curriculum to do a distance MDiv in 3 years without ever moving.
Wow.
Now, it's more likely that if you work hard, you're going to do it in four, because a lot of these students have...
They've got jobs.
They've got jobs. They've got families. But according to the schedule, you're able to do that. Now, where the Hebrew fits in, I have been teaching that Hebrew 1, 2, and Hebrew exegesis for the global campus, which is where our Orlando students have been able to get that credit. Mm-hmm. And it's been my, I guess, my online, electronic, my hybrid half Hebrew, half Logos software, mm-hmm. but that's going away at the end of 2019, mm-hmm. and it's going to be replaced by a traditional approach to teaching Hebrew, albeit delivered online.
Okay.
And there is a difference between, in my estimation, from my years of experience of teaching fully online and teaching hybrid classes, an online class is not a face-to-face class delivered over the internet. Mm-hmm. There are different strategies, different objectives that you use in accomplishing your goals. But the new version, which is in good hands, it's going to be taught, I gather, by Miles Van Pelt. Okay. And Miles has been around the block. He knows what he's doing. He has the Hebrew courses already published with Zondervan.
Yeah.
And so it's in good hands, but it's going to be a significantly different approach than what I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Any other books you want to tell us about? Something that you've recently authored? That you want
to promote? Well, I'm surprised you asked that question.
There's more.
there is a book that should be out this summer. So as you're thinking about what do I buy my friends and family and neighbors and pastor and everybody that I know at work, what do I buy them for Christmas?
Right.
It's called An Introduction to the Hebrew Accents.
Okay.
you laugh.
You're right, I am.
but I will say, out of all the books that I've ever written, this hands down has been the most fun book I've ever written.
Okay, now are you doing that with an angle toward how this is an exegetical aid?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because
that's a huge value add.
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of background to that. I'm not a philosopher or the son of a philosopher, but when I went to seminary, I was trained in the school of Cornelius Van Til.
Okay.
One thing I took away from Van Til was the idea that you don't have to have exhaustive knowledge in order to have true knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with regard to the Hebrew accents, two mistakes are made. One, sometimes if somebody does want to teach them, they feel like students have to know absolutely everything about the accent system. And students are going to get lost in the forest for the trees. We do not need to turn them into Masoretes in order to have them use the accents mm-hmm. exegetically in a beneficial way. The other extreme is, well, they're just so complicated, I'm not going to bother teaching them anything at all. Mm-hmm. And so I've come up with a via media. And so I'm going to teach them enough about the accents that they can use them exegetically without getting them lost in the forest for the trees.
Okay.
So in the basic flow of the book is that I introduce them to the concept, the fundamental concept of continuous dichotomy. An accent breaks a verse in half, then you break the halves in half, then you break the halves of the halves in half. And I teach them the big disjunctive accents.
Yeah.
Then I teach them the conjunctive accents, which don't play as major a role in the exegetical process. And then after that, I have a chapter on how to use this stuff in the exegetical process.
Do you use Daniel 9, the weeks, as an example of this?
I do not.
Okay.
No. I'm also neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, and I'm not an apocalypticist. So,
you're not going to use the accents to justify an eschatological position.
No, but most people who read the Hebrew Bible with the accents are postmillennial.
Okay, all right.
So where was I?
Yeah.
Oh yes. So in this chapter on how to use them, it's arbitrary, but it's heuristic. I divide them into three categories. Okay. Places where you can see that the accents make a subtle difference. For example, in the context of the Shema, it says, repeat them to your sons and talk about them when you, and then it gives the various environments. Mm-hmm. And I think when we pick up our English Bible, we're led to think, repeat them to your sons, number one, and teach them and repeat them or speak about them in all these environments. But if you look at the accents, the verse is cut in half after speak about them. So it's okay. Repeat them and speak about them.
So all the other ones are on equal footing.
And in other words, those qualifications of when and where, that qualifies the whole half of the verse, not just the speaking. Now, nobody's going to go to hell if they don't know that. Am I allowed to say that in this podcast? You know what I mean? Right. But it does make a small difference. Yeah. And there are scads of places where you see these small differences. Another one is at the end of Job. Some translations lead you to believe that that there were Job's sons, and there were Job's daughters, and there were the rest of Job's family. Mm-hmm. But when you read the accents, there are only two groups, the sons and the daughters, and the rest of the people. So subtle differences. Mm-hmm. There are also places where it makes a more significant difference. Now, I'm not saying this is my view, mind you. I'm saying this is the view of the Masoretes. You'll appreciate this if you haven't seen it.
Go ahead.
It's in Genesis 1, I think it's the 21st verse. It says, God created, and then there are four direct objects. And the first is the big tanin, the big taninim. And then you get three other direct objects, and then you get the expression, God saw that it was good.
Okay.
So you have two main predications in this verse. Number one, God created all the direct objects. Number two, God saw that it was good. Now, logically, where the Masoretes would normally divide that verse in half, and half has nothing to do with verb length or word length, it's sense, it would be God created, and then here are four direct objects, major pause, and then it would say God saw that it was good. Ah, but it doesn't. The Masoretes put the major disjunctive accent on taninim gadolim, which is weird.
But that's, it is weird. It's also interesting.
Now, let me tell you why it's weird.
Okay.
They have made the major division that separates four of the direct objects, the first from the next three. In a sense, that makes no sense. Now, but why?
But the statement.
When you look at it from a linguistic point of view, in terms of tree structure, the Atnach divides the verse in half. And so as in the Logos Hebrew cantillation system, we're going to call Atnach A the first half and Atnach B the second half. But you see, the God saw that it was good is Zakef B.
Okay.
And what that means is, like the example with Deuteronomy, and God saw that it was good only qualifies the last three direct objects, it does not qualify the taninim.
Yeah, those are the great sea dragons, the sea serpents.
Yeah.
So, but that makes conceptual sense because of the whole chaos metaphor.
Yeah. So you ask the question, why did the Masoretes put the accent there?
You've sold your book now, so it just
they want to dissociate the tanin. Mm-hmm. From the affirmation that it was good.
The affirmation of goodness.
Now, I'm not saying this is my interpretation.
Okay. All right.
I'm just telling you what the Masoretes are thinking.
For me, so.
Is that good?
That's good.
You going to buy the book?
I'm going to buy the book.
Okay.
Thanks for spending some time with us and talking about what you do. And again, I get questions all the time about where can I take a class? Where can I take a degree? I don't want to move. I want to go to school. There you go. RTS, again, has been in the distance ed business a long time, so you might want to check them out. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Mike.
All right, Mike, those are three great interviews. I really liked Gary. I'm a big fan of the Bible Project, and we also have Tim and John coming on in 2 or 3 weeks on our podcast, so stay tuned for that. But three great interviews, and we've got a ton more to come. So, all right, well, we just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.